There's a Zen koan that goes very approximately like this. The ox, or the bull, jumps through the window, jumps out the window. But the tail remains behind. The tail doesn't make it. It doesn't mean the tail gets cut off and left behind, but somehow. And the bull in Zen lore is often symbolic of enlightenment or the enlightened person. And I don't really understand this koan, so I should make that clear first as a koan. But anyway, the enlightened person. And I see the window as being kind of jumping out the window, jumping out into freedom, out of the confined space of a house, perhaps, and out into freedom. And so the whole bull, this big, massive bull, is able to jump out the window. But not everything gets out. There's something left. The tail gets left behind. So it's kind of a funny image, you know, this poor bull, you know, hanging by the tail out of the window. But the idea of something being left behind. And one of the reasons I like this little story is it points to the issue of perfection and our imperfection. The idea for me, the idea of the tail gets left behind, is always something which kind of doesn't quite make it. And what do we do with that part of ourselves which remains imperfect or remains odd or doesn't quite go all the way through into some kind of great freedom? And as I've looked, you know, I've been involved in spiritual practice over many years and looked at different forms of practice and different teachings and stuff like that, I see that there's a kind of two general teachings around spirituality that can be distinguished. And that is the kind of teachings that focus more on our imperfections and or acknowledge them, or see them, or relate to them. And the other part is the kind of teaching that focuses more on perfection. And it's often been said that Indian religions tend to be focused much more on the perfection side of the spiritual life. And sometimes in Indian spirituality, there's a kind of ideal is to become kind of a perfect human being, someone who's perfectly enlightened, fully enlightened, reaching some level of perfection. And there's even a book published in English, something like The Perfect Man in Buddhism. It was published a long time ago by a woman author. the idea of perfection. And it's a very strong archetype, the idea of a perfected human being. And in Buddhism, you see it in the iconography of the kind of the hagiography of the Buddha as someone who has, there's 32 marks of the Buddha, 32 characteristics of a Buddha's body. And is supposed to be a perfect human being in many ways, with these perfect characteristics. So some of them are kind of odd in our eyes, like the arms are supposed to be so long that they reach down to the knees. And they have Buddhas have webbed fingers, and various kinds of things. But the idea is in the old kind of system, is that the Buddha was someone who was in some ways perfected, both physically and emotionally, in many different ways, and spiritually. So two different kind of divides, two different ways of looking at the human being. One is the side of imperfection, one is perfection. And I see here, especially here in the West, there tends to be much stronger emphasis on somehow coming to terms with our imperfection. And some of you see it in Western Dharma teachers who teach a lot of the talk about acceptance, accepting who we are. You see it in many different strands of Western kind of spiritual thought. One of the places where it's quite prominent, I believe, is in recovery, is in AA, where it's very important to recognize our imperfections or our faults or our errors or mistakes. And the argument is sometimes made in AA is that it's the non-acceptance of those, or struggling against them, trying to reach perfection, that is part of the symptom, of the part of the problem. And that if we kind of really accept ourselves very deeply, who we are, our faults, our imperfections, our errors, our mistakes we've made, that in that acceptance of it, we stop trying to be God. We stop trying to be perfect, trying to control everything. And in that acceptance, we find a certain kind of peace or well-being or serenity that sometimes people are trying to get through alcohol and drugs. So something in the acceptance of our faults and our imperfections is where freedom is found, some kind of freedom. And I've seen people, including myself, who've had perfectionist ideals about the spiritual life and have suffered because of holding those ideals, trying to live up to them, trying to measure myself according to some standard, trying to have a perfect meditation or perfect mind or perfect this or that, perfect response to the situation. To, you know, if I just knew how to be completely compassionate, you know, then the situation would be perfect, right? I'd know what to do, and everybody would live happily ever after. You know, there's the great myth. I think it's a myth. I hope it's a myth of the perfect parent. And sometimes it's maybe the children who suffer under that myth the most. But the idea of the perfection and it can be, of course, a source of a lot of suffering if this is the way it is. There's a philosophy of parenting where it's that they say being good enough is good enough. You're not supposed to look to be perfect. You're supposed to be good enough, and good enough. So one of the questions then is, how do we relate to that part of ourselves, if there is that part of us? If there isn't that part of us, you can go now, part of you, which is somehow could be called imperfect or is flawed or is not always knows what to do in a situation, how to respond, how to deal with things in life completely, perfectly well. How do we deal with our shortcomings? How do we relate to them? When I was ordained as a Zen priest, ordained in 1982, and I didn't have much thought about ritual and the value of rituals, and I just was going to do this ordination, go through this ritual, and that they're just these steps you go through. But the ritual actually had a big impact on me. But one of the impacts, what I noticed before and after that ritual, was that in being ordained as a Zen Buddhist monk or priest, I felt in some way that I was a child of the Buddha. Somehow, kind of the Buddha was this parental figure, and in some kind of archetypical way or mythical way, I was now entered into the fold of being, not just a disciple of the Buddha, but a child of the Buddha. And so there was this level of acceptance of who I was. And then the other aspect that I saw was I became much more self-conscious or self-aware of my faults after I was ordained. And partly it made some sense because if you shave your head and wear robes, you become a public figure. And so your behavior is scrutinized much more. You stand out more. If you say something, then people notice more. But for good and worse. So I noticed my imperfections, my faults much more that I had. They stood out much more. However, it was more okay to have them than before. And that wonderful juxtaposition of seeing them and not being very conscious of them, not pushing away or denying them, but at the same time having this spaciousness, this openness, this acceptance of them, this okayness with them being there, was part of the wonderful delight of what happened after the ordination. So some kind of acceptance, some kind of space for them to be that way. It wasn't that then I kind of just, continued to be an obnoxious person and just kind of ignored people. But rather, I felt very important to work on that, to kind of try to work with that and try to become kinder and not so angry in the different ways that I was. But it was more okay. It wasn't like I was upset or angry with myself for being the way I was. It wasn't that I was felt that this proved that I was an unworthy person or bad in some way. I was freed of a certain kind of judgmentalism, way of judging myself negatively that kind of drained me by going through this little ceremony. So I thought that was really great. Now, I hope that you don't have to go through a ceremony to have that kind of benefit. I hope it's something we can all have just through a little bit of wisdom in our life that, oh, can we be more attentive? Can we notice our shortcomings, our faults, the errors we make? Can we confess them? Can we be open to them? And at the same time, can we be more at peace in that process of acknowledging what they are? Can we see them and feel them and recognize them and admit them and find some peace in doing that? And then when we start working on that, trying to, you know, improve it and change it and not act on our impulses or whatever, can we do it in a way that is not burdened by a feeling of lack of, burdened with, you know, self-anger, self-reproach, but rather a sense of compassion for ourselves or delight or joy in who we are. So I've known a lot of people, including myself, who try to do Buddhist practice where somehow it was not acceptable to be imperfect. You know, somehow I had to get rid of that side or ignore that side or not admit that side. And it's taken a number of different symptoms, different kind of manifestations of that kind of situation. One of them was that, like a little newborn duckling, you know, a little duckling, it kind of sees whatever and bonds to the mother. You know, if it sees a human, it bonds to that, you know, and tries to... So when I was a brand new Zen student, I'm kind of like the first Zen priest that I saw. That's what I was supposed to be like. And I was supposed to be just like him. And he was... And I spent a little bit of time at Zen Center and went away for 2 years. And I, for 2 years, I had this idea I was supposed to be just like him. And he was a little bit kind of a... He had a kind of, you know, perfectionist way of carrying himself through the world. So, you know, some people carry themselves a certain way, a certain stature, certain charisma. And so it kind of added to that kind of sense of, oh, that's what it's supposed to be like. And then after 2 years, I went back to Zen Center. And then I saw there were more priests. There were other priests there. And I looked around. They weren't like him. You know, they weren't just like him. In fact, I remember seeing Philip Whalen, who was a Zen priest by that time, famous beat poet. He was a priest at Zen Center. You know, at Zen, you're supposed to do one thing at a time. If you eat, you just eat. You know, if you walk, you just walk. Well, he was sitting there at breakfast, eating his cold cereal, dripping, and reading the paper. Wait a minute, you know, I had this idea, Zen, you're perfect, just read, you know, if you just read the paper, you read the paper. If you eat your cereal, you eat your cereal. But doing both and dripping. What? And luckily, I didn't judge him terribly. You know, he doesn't get Zen, but rather what it did to me, it freed me from this idea that I was supposed to be like the first guy. That was the whole point, and that was quite liberating. And then a story I haven't told for a while now, so maybe I'm allowed to say it again. And since it's okay to have imperfections, I can be imperfect in my talks too, right? By repeating myself. When I was also a relatively new Zen student, I was sitting, I went to a little sitting group twice a week, and we met in someone's small little bedroom. And in the Zen style, you sit with your eyes open, meditating against the wall. And because it was a small bedroom, we had our knees up against the wall. And I sat down one day to meditate, and suddenly, this Roman column rose up in front of me. Massive Roman column. Kind of that column that, you know, tells you that the bank has a lot of authority and weight and seriousness, you know. Really massive column. And written on this column was the letters inscribed and painted black was letters Z-E-N. And then I don't know when the hallucination stopped and when reality came in, but this is what my experience was. I then went to embrace this big column. And as I embraced it, it disappeared. And I fell forward, and my head hit the wall. And so being kind of slow, you know, sometimes you have to kind of, you know, get a little jolt to kind of wake up and notice. So one of the things I thought about that and reflected and I noticed from that experience was that I was chasing after Zen. Zen was this great authoritative religious tradition, the great thing, the great perfect thing. It's out there. And I'm supposed to go there and come embrace it and get it and become it or whatever. And I realized that there's no Zen. There's no Buddhism out there to get. And that in a sense, the practice of Buddhism was not to get Buddhism, but in some way was to understand myself or to wake up here. And to, as the Zen Master Dogen said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, to be liberated from the self. But the process is to come in here. And then something happens. So then I turned the attention around and stopped kind of chasing after Zen out there as if it was books and teachings and this and that, or perfect meditation experiences, but rather turn the mirror around. Okay, what is happening here? What's going on here? So the value of turning around and starting here. So I'll give you a little exercise. You don't have to do this. You can just imagine you can do it. So imagine you're standing up on your tippy toes. You're bouncing on your tippy toes. And then you're told to jump. How far can you jump? Not very far? Can't jump at all? Just but in order to jump, what you have to do is really jump well and high. You have to bend down and crouch down, and then you could leap. You can jump. Crouching tiger, right? And so in the same way, there's something about, I understand in spiritual life, there's a very important aspect of crouching down, of settling back into ourselves, deeply into ourselves. And the more we can settle into ourselves, into our heart, into our hara, into our body, and settle into it, then it gives us a platform from which we can do that leap out the window like that bull. We can leap out, we can leap somewhere, we can do something. And so a very important part of a spiritual life as I've lived it, and as I think it's true for many people, is some way of settling back into who we are before going out or before leaping into freedom. So discovering who we are. What is here? What is in our hearts? What is in our bodies? What is in our minds? What is in there really deeply? I've known people who spent years doing meditation practices that brought a lot of bliss. You can do that. You know, you can learn certain practices that bring a lot of ecstasy. And but they never had much paying attention. And then they've come to retreats that I've taught where we teach them to pay attention rather than go into bliss states. And some of them are unwilling to make the shift because they're into this kind of perfection maybe mode. But if some of them who have been willing to make the shift, sometimes it's a shock to find out what was going on in here. They had no idea all this stuff was going on, all this subconscious stuff, all this movements and feelings. And they realized the degree to which the bliss experience was kind of repressing or holding back what was here. So a very important part, I think, especially of Vipassana practice then, is this crouching down, this settling down, back, finding out what is here. And then as we find out what's here, admitting it, confessing it, acknowledging it, feeling it, being it in a sense, how do we hold it? How do we hold it so it's not more material for self-reproach? Can we hold it in such a way that we're more spacious about it, more accepting of it? So we're a child of the Buddha, for example, or it's okay to be this way. Is it okay to be human? Or are we supposed to be perfect? And I would argue that it's a lot easier if you start where it's okay to be human, okay to be, to accept the fact that we have flaws, perhaps, or we have shortcomings, or we have made mistakes in our lives, and we don't always know what to do, we're not always in control, we're not always, happy, or, you know, we can be grumpy, you know. We can kind of acknowledge who we are, and acknowledge the range of it, how it changes over the days, and over the hours, and over the months. That goes up and down, up and down. So some kind of deep acceptance of this. So that allows us to kind of to leap, to jump more properly. It allows for a number of different things. One of the things it allows for is it allows for greater access to compassion, to understand ourselves well and understand our shortcomings, is to touch the wellsprings of compassion, is to be able to understand, recognize other people when they suffer, recognize other people that have shortcomings, even if you're perfect. Most people, you know, are not, are they? And in fact, the people who think they're the most perfect are often the ones who see the most imperfection in others. But if we can kind of see ourselves as, you know, have some compassionate way of holding ourselves, then I think it's a lot easier to have some compassion and understanding for others. And I think the world needs a tremendous amount of compassion. Compassion for ourselves, self-compassion, and compassion for the world around us. And if we don't have compassion for our neighbors and friends, look out, because sooner or later you're going to need their compassion. Compassion is kind of the currency of human relatedness and relationships, the flow of care, of kindness that moves through us. So that's one benefit from kind of really being willing to admit who we are, or be present for who we are in some deep way. Another benefit is that as we begin opening up, accepting, holding an awareness, all of who we are, that the container for, or the holder, or the awareness that holds that, starts being seen as being distinct from our personality, our personal qualities, our personal characteristics. That all the different aspects of our personality, the ones that are beautiful, the ones that are not, if we're identified with those, if we're preoccupied with those, if we're enmeshed in it, there's very little freedom there. And if you're rejecting it, there's also very little freedom there. Rejecting something is being as enmeshed in something as holding on to it. But as we can accept something and allow it to be there and be generous about its presence, be open to it, then we begin discovering the benefits, the sweetness of the openness, the sense of a kind of fresh air that's in the open space that holds and lets something be there. So if we find ourselves, for example, being angry, then to back up in a sense, or open up a little bit, just hold the anger as if you can hold a little, you know, little bird or something in your hand, very gently, very softly. Just hold it there kindly. And you kind of hold it there and see it. Then the space around it, or the kindness that holds it, is one of the windows. The bulb jumps through the window, right? The windows towards becoming freer. Now, the beautiful thing about this is that it's in the space of freedom, the space of non-clinging, the space of open awareness, that we can find something of the qualities of perfection. The mind, which is, and this is what Buddhism is pointing towards, is moving the mind, or moving the heart, to that place where there's no clinging, nothing we identify with, nothing we get enmeshed in or hold on to. The possibility of an awareness, or the knowing, which is not enmeshed or entangled with anything at all. Now, if we try to just get that, or go there directly sometimes, it's kind of like going for perfection, and it has a lot of problems, just going for perfection. But if we find it by acknowledging and accepting what is here fully, and then notice that in the cracks or in the space around that acceptance, and the sweetness in that acceptance, and that presence, that mindfulness, that there is this kind of freedom, this openness, then what we're finding is that the perfection is found through the imperfection. That the perfection is found as with the help of the imperfection. We don't have to reject part of ourselves to find that place of perfect freedom. So both, to be able to hold both at the same time. So the bull jumps through the window, but the tail gets left behind. Part of us gets left behind. Part of us, we can stay who we are. We don't have to become this perfect person. We can be someone exactly who we are. One of my favorite little stories from the early Buddhist tradition is a story of an arhat, who's a fully awakened, a perfected person. He's perfect, you know, he's fully perfected in terms of enlightenment. And he's out wandering around with other monks. And they come to a river that they have to cross. And these, you know, monks wear these robes. And so he jacks up his skirt in the most unbecoming way, maybe even above his waist. They don't wear underwear. It just pulls them up, right? And then he prances across the river, you know, splashing all the way across. And the other monks are scandalized by this, because this is very unbecoming of a monk. A monk has a very decorous. And you have to accept my problems with the English language. Part of my imperfection is, anyway, you got the point, a certain kind of proper behavior. And so the other monks go to the Buddha to complain and say, so-and-so, he's supposed to be an arhat, you said he's an arhat, but let us tell you how he crossed that river. And the Buddha said, oh, don't worry. He is, in fact, fully enlightened. However, for 500 years, no, for 500 lifetimes, he was a monkey. And sometimes his monkey nature comes through. That monkey nature, comes through. So what were you for 500 years? And, maybe you were a squirrel. So in your fully enlightened nature, you're going to be timid. Or maybe you were a silent sage, and so for 500 lifetimes. And so in this lifetime, you'd be enlightened, but you're going to be really quiet. Just kind of stay by yourself and all that. And that's who you are, quiet, kind of contemplative kind of person. Or maybe for 500 lifetimes, or maybe because of genes, who knows why? 500 lifetimes just means who knows why. maybe you're gregarious. I read this book recently with a person who's contrasting, I think mostly children. The book was contrasting children. Children who have, I think it's called the Williams syndrome versus children who had Asperger's syndrome. And they're kind of opposites of each other. And the Williams syndrome are kids who have a little bit of mental retardation, but they have tremendous empathy of everybody else around them. They just kind of tune in. They're empaths, right? Like in Star Trek. And they just come up and are really friendly, and everybody becomes their best friend within 10 minutes. Where kids have Asperger's syndrome, they have very little empathy. And they can be very bright. They can have great logical skills and good at math. And I know one who started reading when he was 3, but has almost no sense of how to read other people, and no empathy. And has to do with, so there's a huge range of how people are. And even people in the normal range of being a human being can have a range of, some people are more empathic than others, some people less, some people have more rational, linear, some people are more other ways. And we're all different from each other. And how to accept all the differences and different qualities that we are, different ways that we are. And how not to assume that as you become a freer person, that you're supposed to fit some archetype of perfection. I'm supposed to be just like that first Zen priest I met, just like this or just like that. I'm supposed to be just like Mother Teresa. That's it. Or I'm supposed to be just like, so-and-so. I think that in a sense, I don't want to say it's the point. I'm not going to say it's the point, but the manifestation or the one of the consequences of greater freedom is we become more and more ourselves. And in a funny way, the more we kind of become selfless, the more we also become ourselves. We kind of, who we are as a character stands out more and more. Or as Jack Kornfield has said, of all of the different people he's met, who many great spiritual teachers and people who practice spiritual practice for 30, 40, 50 years, the more free they become, he says, the more eccentric they become. So, are you willing to become eccentric? Are you willing to become who you are? And some of you are one way and some another way. And some of you are your way is completely ordinary. You don't stand out in the crowd at all. In this crowd, other places you would stand out. And some of you stand out, and some of you are odd. I suspect most of you are odd. Or to say it differently, I think most of us are odd. I'm odd. And sometimes you don't see how odd I am because I'm in this role as teacher. Except the way I speak sometimes is odd. But, you know, we're all odd. And Odd Fellows Club. This is wonderful. I don't know where they got that name, but it's a great name. You know, you could sign up. I guess. I don't know if only men, can only men be Odd Fellows? Anyway, there's down in San Jose, there's this big property called the Odd Fellows. It's a club. So there's a spirituality of imperfection, there's a spirituality of perfection, and then what I tried to do today is to show how there's a way of bringing them together so that they both fit together. And there's no perfection without imperfection, no imperfection without perfection. And that somehow holding who we are with openness, kindness, compassion, and care is one of the ways to begin discovering that dimension of our psyche, that dimension of life, that in a sense is perfect, can find perfection. We have a few minutes if anyone would like to ask any questions or have any comments or anything, you're welcome to, but anything. If you don't mind doing the microphone.
Well, this question has nothing to do with what you were talking about today, but I was just hoping that at some point we could talk about the relationship between John Paul II and Buddhism and how he reached out to so many different peoples, poor, Jewish, labor movement, etc. And I just was curious about whether he and Buddhists reached out to each other in any way.
And then this morning,
so that could be talked about any time in the future.
I don't know so much about that. But this morning Chronicle, there's a photograph of the Dalai Lama visiting the Pope in the Vatican. And I have a picture of the Zen master I studied with in Japan. He did a field trip to the Vatican also. There's a picture of him and the Pope together. I don't know how much he reached out, but I know people sometimes went to visit him. I don't know much about it. I know some people were quite upset. He wrote a book that had a kind of uninformed view about Buddhism, and he was quite critical of Buddhism in the book. But you know, I don't think he knew what he was talking about. Or if he did, then I'm in trouble. But say a little bit more while you're asking. Is it very moving for you that he passed away, or meaningful for you, or?
I've just been so intrigued listening to the news in the last week, and especially in the last 24 hours, and how he reached out in ways that, I mean, not only was he Polish, and approached life from the unique Polish perspective, and the concentration camps and so on. But he just seemed to have a kind of compassion for people outside of, I guess that it used to be that the popes reached out primarily to wealthy Catholics and that the ordinary Catholic people were sort of left behind. And he saw he felt that that wasn't true to his religion. And so he just seemed to me to be so much more compassionate and so much more broad-based in his perspectives that I just wondered whether there was any application to Buddhism.
Any what?
Application to Buddhism in his
Buddhism?
Own life.
Yeah, I don't really know.
Just one thing. As a Pole and a mother who was a recovering Catholic, the one thing I think that probably is the most significant thing was when he was, there was an assassination attempt, and a couple of years later he went into that man's cell and said that he was forgiven. It almost seemed, when you were talking today, that came drifted through my mind of accepting someone else's pointing a gun at you. And I feel like that, it seemed very, rang very true. I don't know about all the media hype and so on, and I'm sure there's some very, a lot of that, but that seemed like a really important and seminal thing that he did.
Mm-hmm.
thanks first. And thanks for mentioning AA. I am a member, and one of the things that has been really eye-opening for me is in front of the preamble that's read at all the meetings is we are not saints. We see spiritual progress, not perfection. And when one thinks about how many people out there suffer from any kind of addiction and don't recover and go an entire life, I think what works in that program is that there isn't, it's an applicability of the spirit to acknowledging imperfection and just what you're saying, like, and finding that, like you said, like if there was perfection, we could all just go home, you know? And I'm thinking also, too, I've been listening to Stages of Meditation by the Dalai Lama, and talks one of the goals is to, the goal. He talks about the Bodhisattva goal, if one is to pursue that, of reaching omniscience, for lack of a better translation, and that omniscience, like everything else, has a cause. It doesn't just, if it existed without a cause, then a mountain could be omniscient, or everything could be omniscient. But I'm thinking out hearing you that cause is imperfection. First is imperfection, then you have something to work with.
Yeah, maybe so.
I don't know if I have a question.
Yeah, maybe so. The two most famous stories in Southeast Asia, Buddhist stories, one is the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, how he left the palace and became enlightened. And that we know pretty well here in the West. But the other story is a story, which we don't have time for me to tell the whole story. Maybe another day I can tell you the story. But it's a story of the Buddha in the lifetime before this one, before the one he got enlightened in, because there's all these stories of his past lives. And that story, he was a prince named Vesantara, and he had this flaw, one flaw, big flaw, and that was he was too generous. And so he started giving away not only all his father's wealth and, he started giving away things that weren't even his to give away. And so this became too much, too difficult for the people, people insisted the king had to banish him from the kingdom. And so he was banished, and he went and lived in these jungles. But he still had this tendency to give. He's so generous, just giving, giving, giving. And so he ends up giving away his children and his wife, who goes with him into the jungle. And this description of this usually is full of pathos. And when the story is told, because it's told a lot in Thailand places, people all cry and they're quite upset that this happens. They're kind of really identify with the pain of giving away children and wife. But his generosity is so strong. And then at some point the story continues and one of the great gods comes down and makes everything right and brings his rejoins the family, and he goes back to his kingdom and becomes the king. So it's kind of kind of wimps out the story in some ways, but. The traditional interpretation of the story is that in order to become a Buddha, he has to perfect the virtue of generosity. His generosity has to become perfect in order to have the qualities to become a Buddha. And so giving away even your children and your wife, that's really proving it. You've done it, nothing's left behind. You're giving away everything. So my interpretation of story, with all the imperfection I bring with me to interpret stories and understand Buddhism, my interpretation of story is that before he could become a Buddha, he had to make a colossal mistake. and he, giving away your children and your wife, that was a colossal mistake. And it's realizing that level of mistake, shortcoming, that allowed him to develop the level of compassion that was necessary in order to become a Buddha. So rather than perfecting his generosity, he had to perfect his compassion. And the ways he did that was by making a huge mistake and realizing his mistake. So, don't make those mistakes.
Okay.
Please. So, thank you very much. It's lovely to be here this morning. I hope that the life of the Pope can inspire all of us to great deeds of compassionate acceptance. Thank you.